Thank you, Jerry. The final paper in the series is entitled LSI in Use, the Practical Approach, by Bill Wicks of Texas Instruments. Bill hails from Roanoke, Virginia. He obtained his BS at Johns Hopkins, went to work for GE in Syracuse, and then Hughes out in Culver City, and is now at TI, where he's the manager of advanced integration programs. Bill?
TI, with its sole approach to discretionary routing, makes me feel somewhat like the commercial on the man smoking the first filler cigarettes, all alone in the world. We don't think we will continue to be alone too long. Could I have the first slide, please? We're announcing, too, fundamentally the work that is being done and has been completed on the Air Force contract relating to an LSI computer program. This shows a representation not of the LSI computer, but of the discrete integrated circuit version of the LSI computer that we chose to implement. This particular conversion contains approximately 1,735 flat packs laid out on over 200 printed circuit boards. In terms of the LSI version, we translated this into 34 LSI arrays of 14 different types. Each array then contains over 200 logic gate equivalents. This particular computer was built to serve as a demonstration research vehicle for this technology. It is a 16-bit word machine with a 2 megahertz clock rate and is designed into a solid-state radar program. This is a picture of an array without the lid. Here we're using the full slice, and the diameter of this particular piece of silicon is 1.5 inches. It has two additional levels of metallization on it, over and above the first level metal, which is used to characterize each cell or each part of the slice as a gate or a flip-flop. This shows the monolithic wafer, the 1.5-inch diameter silicon, before the multi-layers of metallization are applied. This is the same sort of slice that integrated circuits typically produce, and at this point they would dice it into chips, package it in flat packs, and you would have it available for equipment implementation and mount in the terms of mounting flat packs on a PC board. Our particular game is to take the wafer as it is, probe the wafer, find out where the cells are, interconnect them with additional layers of metallization, and convert it into a functional operating logic unit. In order to do this, we must then give you on the wafer the same thing that you might have available in terms of the flat pack. That is, not just a single circuit type on the wafer, but a variety of logic types on the same wafer. Using a slice this large, and knowing that we will not get 100% yield across the slice, then we need to have a probe system where we can economically probe the slice to determine the location of the circuits. This shows a typical probe setup with a test station next to it. It's computer-controlled and automatically indexes each cell under the probe heads. The validity of the circuit type, then, is stored on computer tape to be used with a routing program. The interconnection of these circuit types on the wafer is determined from what we call a discretionary routing computer-generated program. Once the program for the interconnection program is determined for that unique wafer, we use a cathode ray tube system to produce metallization mask. The fact that we need unique metallization mask for each wafer type because of the random distribution of the good cells, we need an economical way to produce these masks. So instead of using a Gerber plotter or manual type of technology, we have developed a precision CRT system, and through a lens transport and film transport system, we do a direct development of the metallization mask on the film. Processing the film, we use that in direct contact with a wafer then to produce the interconnection metallization patterns. This is a typical composite of the various levels of metallization over and above the first level that winds up interconnecting the circuits on the array. In true form, this is about a little less than 1.5 inches in diameter. And as you can see, the complexity of the interconnection that results. As I said, this is a composite of what we would normally refer to as the additional second level of metallization and third level, showing that it's fundamentally X and Y oriented. Basically, all of our programming of the cathode ray tube system and of our probe stations is handled by our own internal computer system. And this is just using a general purpose machine to control an artwork generator. This shows a typical logic diagram, and the objective here is just to show you the order of complexity we're talking about. When this Air Force contract was started, about 4 to 6 circuit gates were the level of complexity that were being produced as a separate IC chip. At Texas Instruments, we gave the logic system partitioner the ability to use up to 250 gates to do his partitioning with. In order to also get advantage, we gave him a distribution of flip-flops and circuit gate types on the wafer. This makes the job simpler from the logic designer's point of view. He now can use circuits that are exactly identical to what he might get out of the catalog in terms of NAND gates and JK flip-flops. The photomasks have to be generated for the required printed circuit boards. The interconnecting metallization to be used as on the integrated circuits on the board, and the test techniques must provide sufficient confidence that the PC board is functioning properly. In terms of discretionary large-scale integration at Texas Instruments, a printed circuit board containing 70 flat packs, this is about 200 logic gates, can be replaced with a single monolithic wafer. This represents a packaging density of better than 100 gates per square inch. The discretionary program at TI has served to demonstrate that practical solutions have been found for the above problems. We're saying that large slices have been fabricated containing a variety of cell types. This is a close-up of that same slice showing that there is, in fact, a variety of circuit types on the wafer itself. By being able to process gates, flip-flops, in an individual cell, such as you would for ICs, but treating that cell as though it were an integrated circuit available to the logic designer, we can put within the cell additional items, such as full adders, and/or networks, an up-down counter bit, or shift register bits. We have established that probe tests on the wafer do provide reliable data, as to the location of the good cells. Computer-controlled equipment has been developed which generates the unique interconnection mask for each wafer at a low cost. The multi-level interconnect technology has progressed to where current densities, yields, and pinholes are no longer a major economic constraint. This is a slice of the wafer after the applications of second and third level metallization. At the present time, there are 2 large-scale integrated slice types available. This logic slice that I have shown you contains 128 JK flip-flops, along with 646 1, 3, 5, and 7 input NAND gates. This is a general-purpose logic slice, and can be used to implement any logic function of up to 250 gates. The circuits are equivalent to the standard TI series 5400 transistor-transistor logic. This slice has been used to implement custom logic as well as standard products, such as a digital differential analyzer, and for complexity, a 20-bit up-down synchronous counter, and a full 8-bit adder with look-ahead carry. We have a second slice type available at the present time, which is a shift register type. It is composed of unique cells. I need that slide back still. It is composed of cells that have been dedicated to a shift register design. Obviously, a shift register is a very, very well structured and orderly logic array. In this slide, we see the yellow sections containing 4-bit shift register cells. The red contains the clock drivers. They're in the center where the yield is the highest. The blue is on the outside, and they are output buffer drivers. Fundamentally, we use a unique cell here, since we're not interfacing with the outside world every time we go from one shift bit cell to the other, as you do in flat packs. We can design the cell for an optimum power-speed trade-off configuration. With this slice, we can implement up to a 1,000-bit shift register, DC to 10 megahertz capability, approximately 1.5 milliwatts per bit for the shift bits. By the computer-generated routing program, we can make any chain length you need. A paper covering this device was presented at the International Electronic Device Meeting in October of 1968. The computer program that we have had with the Air Force and the above standard type products demonstrate the versatility of the TI discretionary LSI program. The shift register demonstrates the potential that discretionary interconnection of cells on a monolithic wafer can be used to achieve. That is, it contains an interconnection of over 1,000 master-slave flip-flops. And since each master-slave is a 4-bit gate, this is equivalent to 4,000 gates. In conventional integrated circuits, the silicon wafer is made up of a large number of these cells or bars. In discretionary LSI, the wafer is processed in a manner exactly identical to the normal integrated circuit processing. The test procedures, however, are much more thorough, and each cell can contain a different logic function. The wafer is not scribed and it remains intact throughout the remaining processes. While the general purpose logic slice contains only one gate or one flip-flop in a cell, there is no reason that it cannot be designed to contain any cell or logic configuration that could be had in integrated circuit as an individual characterized IC. This approach to LSI results in a very definite low-volume type of product, as contrasted with high-volume requirements generally associated with customizing IC components. The interface requirements for using this approach are a basic logic diagram utilizing the gates and flip-flops available on the wafer. This logic diagram can be the result of the customer's design, or it can be our own system staff implementation of the customer's equations. However, because of the complexity of these products, it is normally desirable that the interface take place upon mutual grounds, with the system requirements being the platform. Partitioning is a major key to effective utilization of the logic capability, minimizing input-output pins and providing functional units. When more than one slice type is involved, the moderate fixed fee per cost per array covering the usual interface conditions and test programs is amortized over the lot. The turnaround time on initial interface is generally 3 to 6 months in order to establish mutually agreeable conditions and implementations. However, once the first lot has been produced, a turnaround time of 4 weeks or less can be anticipated. It should be pointed out that a change in implementation can be accomplished by a simple change in node interconnecting data, since each wafer is discretionarily routed. Thus, discretionary LSI can provide a practical approach to breadboarding, modifying, and finalizing digital equipment design. Interface with this technology can be as simple as a logic diagram, and computer programs are available to verify the logic, simulate performance, create the required routings, and generate test programs. Finally, it has the capability of providing 1 or 1,000 arrays of high complexity, custom logic designs in a short time period, and a cost well below that normally required for custom implementation. As a final statement, I would like to announce that the computer developed under this program is now operational. It was announced this morning and is available for viewing. This particular audience is invited, after this session is over, to go up to the Hotel Pierre in the Sapphire Room and view the computer itself and see its operation. Just as the Hotel Pierre Sapphire Room at 5th Avenue and 61st Street. It will be available from 4:30 to 6 o'clock tonight.
Thank you, Bill. I hope that your use of the word viewing doesn't apply to the generally accepted connotation. At this point, I'd like to ask the panel members to come up and take a seat on the podium and defend themselves against questions from the audience. Could you join us?
I can't give you a good answer to that because we've done complementary MOS in one group in the semiconductor division and the bipolar work in another group, and the environmental conditions were quite different, so I don't think there's a good answer. The question was, how do the defect densities compare in our MOS work and our bipolar work? And the answer was that the environmental conditions are so much different that there's not an accurate comparison, not a meaningful comparison.
Solve the logistic problem of keeping them all separate.
You're referring to the metallization mass?
Yeah, the first level metallization mass.
The question was, how do we keep these metallization masks separate?
Yes, and also, how do you check them for accuracy?
And how do you check them for accuracy? Well, each slice is serialized and has its own serial number. The probe data related to that slice type, then, is stored as a result of that serial number. The metallization mask, and there are four masks for the three-level logic, in other words, the two layers of oxide feed-through holes and the X and the Y metallization patterns, are also serialized. In other words, the computer-generated display puts the mask number, or the serialized number, right on the mask set itself. Does this answer your question?
Yeah, it answers the first part. Now, the second part is, how do you check to be sure that the masks are accurate? Now, the fidelity of the masks are okay.
You mean with regard to registration?
No, regarding the patterns that you are supposed to have. In other words, the...
Are the masks accurate relative to the slice?
Relative to the design.
Relative to the design. I believe if you're saying, is the mask correct? Does the mask actually interconnect to perform the logic function?
That's right.
All right, that's in the test program to verify that, in fact, the interconnection has performed the job it was supposed to do. In the final test of the logic array.
In other words, you wait until the final test.
Beg pardon?
In other words, you wait until the final test. So that if...
We assume that the interconnection given by the computer is correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The question is to Mr. Campo, and the question is that in your block-oriented computer, why is that you went to an array-type architecture? Any particular reason or because
of? There was a reason. We started with the basic desire to use the large wafers as initially fabricated without using multi-layer metallization. We wanted just to have one layer of metallization. And this led us to pick a cell, basic block, where the gate-to-pin ratio would be as high as possible. Now, the cell that we have is roughly 160 mils by 160 mils, has 2,700 transistors in it, and the number of the number of buses entering that cell is approximately 20. So your gate-to-pin ratio is very high. But you could only accomplish this if each cell was a complete arithmetic processing plant. And there were other reasons for selecting that the cell should be a complete processor. These had to do with this redundancy that I was talking about. That is, if your cells were parts of arithmetic plants, they would not be interchangeable. And it's difficult to put that into 10 words or less. But by taking an array processor approach from the very beginning and making each of these cells a complete arithmetic plant, many of the problems that would have obtained otherwise just didn't exist. So that was basically the reason for taking that approach.
Joe, do we understand that you're bringing out all of the connections from each cell?
No.
And then doing electronic switching to switch out the bad cells and switch in the good ones?
Well, I would put it, it's really done in two parts. The first part is that the communication of data between the cells is done through a bus system. That is, each of those arithmetic cells is permanently wired into the bus system. Then the selection so that you don't bring out data from each cell to the edge of the wafer. You bring out the common buses. But then you do have a selection process on the cell level. We've looked into two different techniques for doing this. The first technique was to literally bring the power, which is just one lead, from each of the 36 cells out to the perimeter of the wafer. And then we'd bring power into the cells that were working. Second approach that we've chosen now involves bringing in address lines, and this is the approach that we're settling on, bring address lines into the wafer. Then if you want to select a particular cell, you do an ultrasonic bonding at the cell to bring power in. That's one bond for this 2700 transistor cell. And then the addressing, which is from 1 to 5 more bonds.
I see. You do a subsequent interconnection on the wafer then after that.
That's right, but the number of connections is small enough that it's practical to use ultrasonic bonding. In other words, we have at most 5 connections per cell, and there are 36 cells, so there aren't many connections involved. Yes?
Mr. Witt, I'd like to you to explain something. If you're building 100 identical arrays, after you fabricate these arrays, you test to eliminate the bad gates or flip-flops. Does that mean that you make new masks for each of these 100 different arrays?
Yes.
Really? Isn't that expensive?
Maybe that's why we're alone in the world. It's been quite expensive. It's been quite one of the reasons why it's taken us 3 years, I guess, to get there. But we are, in effect, announcing through the operational demonstration at the IEEE here of this computer that it is now an economic technology.
Bill, I'd like to ask you the same question in a little bit different vein. It's no secret that everybody doesn't agree in this area. And we heard the people from Bell Labs this morning, in fact, talking about how important it was not to make the chip too large, and they were talking about chips or orders of magnitude smaller than your chip and the like, and certainly TI is working in both of these areas, and you have a great deal of experience, probably undoubtedly more than anybody else in the two approaches. How do you see it shaping up now in terms of application? Do you see certain applications that you're quite confident that the discretionary wiring will be applicable to, no matter how large or how small the total volume of business, and other applications where the super chip is going to be better. Would you comment on that?
Basically, if you can isolate these into an MSI-LSI game, which is more difficult because LSI is a buzzword and everybody wants to use it. Let's use the complexity level of above 100 gates, let's say, and say that, all right, above that level, we're saying that if you were doing it as a fixed metallization pattern, you'd obviously need a chip size that is bigger than you would get economically through fixed metallization. So with fixed metallization, you will be limited to chip size. With this limitation, then, obviously, if you want a big array, you've got to use some other technique. And so we've chosen the discretionary approach, and we're also doing beam lead and hybrid assembly work. But the monolithic discretionary approach has a lot of significant advantages that make the whole program very worthwhile. Now, this has been the thing that has led us to where we are today, in a sense, this sort of a philosophy. At the present time, the chips we're using, or the bars, or the cells, however you want to call them, are small enough so that we get yields that are better or as good as what you would get through normal integrated circuits, maybe an 80 by 40 mil bar that we put the circuitry into. With this approach, then, and the and maybe I'm wandering from the subject a little bit, but the processing activity is, yes, a separate metallization mask, and therefore we must have an economical way to produce these masks. This allows us to have a unique interconnection on each and every wafer to change the metallization at will. It certainly is not something that you're going to utilize for 100,000 units a month type of thing. Of course, how many people need a 250 or 500 gate array at 100,000 a month? This is the trade-off, too. If you need extremely large quantities, then it may be very wise to partition as a 100% metallization yield problem. You bulk process this type of activity. But where you can utilize the large gate complexity and where you need, which normally will result in the smaller equipment quantities, this is where we expect to see it utilized to its greatest advantage.
I have a question for Mr. Field. Two questions, actually. Number one, on his placement and wire routing, is that automatic, computer-aided, or hand? And number two, on his simulation, what does the output look like of your simulation program?
The placement and wire routing is not automatic yet. Remember I talked about this bubble layout? Well, the logician develops and partitions his logic. Then it's up to he gives this to the designer. This is a draftsman type person, somewhat higher caliber than that, but that's a fairly routine task to take these standard components, standard cells that we have, and this is a very similar problem to that of laying out a two-sided printed circuit board. And we show with these circles on the bubbles and the horizontal and vertical lines how to interconnect them. And this is really a creative design step. Now, what the computer currently does is to minimize the amount of data required to translate this bubble layout into the standard cell information and interconnection information required to make the actual artwork and to do this without error. So our programs currently, and what our array compiler does really, is to take the names of the standard cells and the starting point that I mentioned, that area I showed in red on that slide, if you might recall that. That Boolean expression plus the standard cell information and that output metal line are all that the computer needs to reconstruct really what it is that the designer did. It's a unique Boolean expression plus the starting point, which the designer put down, and the output metal line. Everything else is automatic. Now, what was the second question? The output of the simulation program will be a set of ones and zeros, which is fed back to the logic designer. Now, normally when a man designs logic, he'll have a pretty good idea of what it is he wants to do. And it's a matter of his verifying that it really does that. For example, and one of the most difficult things was for us to find out what kind of input format could we use which would minimize the amount of data which the logic designer fed to the program in order to exercise this logic. And you will find that most of the patterns which are fed in to exercise the logic are pretty repetitive, and you would generally only have to change one or two bits in a word, for example. And so the real problem wasn't just developing the program, it was one of minimizing the input data and the errors. And this is where we put our main emphasis, because we've had programs which would simulate logic for quite some time. And it's only recently that we've been able to have something which a logic designer could really use as a useful tool for really understanding what it is his logic does, and to know, for example, if he has redundant logic or mistakes. Does that answer your question?
Jack, about how much time does this take now from the time you start your logic, you have your logic diagram, to you get your artwork?
It depends on how many arrays there are to be simulated. Our FAST program can simulate up to 20 chips, the logic contained on up to 20 chips in an unpartitioned form. And a somewhat longer version can simulate up to a unit containing up to 60 chips. Now, the version that simulates 20 chips takes a 40K memory, and it takes roughly, I believe it's about 20 seconds per bit time.
Do you have any more questions?
I have a question for the man from TI. In trying to reduce the parasitic effects in circuitry, the placement of the chip sometimes comes as quite important. And I notice on your 1.5-inch slice there, some of the wire routing is quite far. It seems to be almost the whole length of the slice. And since you're locked in with your chip position, doesn't this present quite a limitation in high-frequency circuitry where you really don't have a choice? You may have to go across the slice for a chip?
All right. Across the slice, as you say, isn't very far, really. We're talking about an inch across the slice, inch and a half. So that in terms of distance and speed, this is pretty good. But it does present a problem in the sense that if you're dealing with ultra-high frequency, the metallization pattern on the wafer itself makes a good capacitor because it's so close to the substrates. And capacitance could be a limiting factor. However, this is one of the reasons for selecting the TTL-type logic. It's characterized as a standard logic circuit. It has much more power capability than is necessary on the slice itself. We literally can dice it apart and sell them as flat-pack chips if we wanted to. So it's got much more drive capability than is necessary within the wafer itself. The shift register is a illustration of a more customized design where the cells go from one cell to the next adjacent cell type of thing. So that here again, it's designed within the known environment that we have on the wafer. This is one of the things that makes it nice in a sense. We know what the environment is on the wafer. We can characterize it. We can predict it. Therefore, we can design and customize the cells and power distributions accordingly.
Jerry, I wonder if you would comment on the related aspects of your computer design. As ECL is notorious for its noise coupling problems and ringing problems and so forth. Did you have to take any special steps to handle this kind of a problem in putting your computer together?
Well, in the array environment, of course, as Bill has said, you're working with very short distances. You need not worry about the loading or termination in such a short distance. In the assembly of the demonstration vehicle, we used the standard wiring rules that we use in our Spectra 70 machines on line lengths, ground planes, and terminations and such. It is a problem working with ECL. It's a very difficult problem.
But not on the chip itself?
Not on the chip, no.
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question of the gentleman from Dallas. Could you clarify? I thought that you said that on that shift register example that there were potentially 1,000 good bits of shift register. Is that correct? That
it
it's 1,000 on a basis of 100% yield?
No, no. There are many more shift bits available on the wafer than 1,000.
I see. How many?
Over 1,800.
Okay. Is that as high as you see it going for?
No, there's no constraint except a processing one. Basically, this first wafer was done with the thought in mind, well, let's see what we can do type of thing. And so they designed a 4-bit shift register cell. And then we distributed a bunch of these around with the clock drivers and the output buffers. As you notice, we don't use the whole slice of silicon. We stay inside of the outer edge of it, if you will. This eliminates the problem of losing circuits as a result of probe handling or anything else. We haven't tried to really optimize that. We are producing a quantity of a 700-bit shift register off of that slice. As an example, we have done some studying to do a design of a dedicated dual 700-bit shift register on a slice. So this particular slice is sort of a general purpose type of thing. We can program it up to eight different strings on the slice itself. In other words, it isn't fully dedicated in that constraint.
If you look into the future, how many bits will you get onto a slice?
Well,
if you look way into the future.
Well, if you want to play a game with me, one of the most complex we've looked at so far has been putting a couple of full adders in each of those cells that I talk about on the wafer. Certainly, a dual full adder is available as an integrated circuit flat pack. Well, it can be available as a cell type. One of the circuits that we have on the drawing board is a dual 8-bit multiplier. Now, an 8-bit multiplier, if you want to play a game, takes about 60 full add cells, and each add cell contains about 10 gates approximately. So we're talking about better than 1,000 logic gates for each 8-bit multiplier. Well, that's two of them, makes 2,000 gates. We're power limited very quickly then, because now we've got too much power. So we need to start doing some new circuit designs. You tend to run up against one barrier after the next. Our first barrier really was the ability to interconnect a large number of gates. The complete random interconnection of gates becomes a limitation of the computer's ability to find the interconnection paths. A highly structured organization, such as the shift register, results in a very simple problem for the computer and is not a constraint at all, except in a power or size constraint. So this is kind of the game. After all, I think the work that RCA has done, getting a 76-gate ECL cell in the chip size they're working with, is a pretty good illustration. Theoretically, there's no reason we couldn't take, the industry, using discretionary capability, could use a wafer containing those cells and interconnect them. So the limit is not so much, well, there are several limits you run up against. Either it's an interconnection capability, it's a power constraint. I think the power constraint is probably our next prime limitation.
Jerry, do you agree that you could take your cells and use his technique and have the best of two worlds?
Yes, basically, as far as the cell design is concerned, you have to leave the extra space for the bonding pads to probe and then interconnect. That takes a little additional space, but I don't see why not.
The interesting thing, too, if you want to get complex, is to carry the translation to MOS chips, where you have very, very dense structures in a small array. And an MOS wafer has a fantastic number of components on it. And there's no reason if we can develop a multi-level metallization scheme for MOS that we can't apply the same tools.
So, Mr. Burroughs, Mr. Herzog, you gave us some description about using photomasks 1 mil off the surface of your silicon wafer.
Now, when you make up these masks, would the geometry be comparable to a mask that you would put on the surface, and how much resolution do you lose in having this mask 1 mil off the surface?
As I indicated, you can resolve adequately 2/10 mil lines with this technique if you have collimated light. The masks are not basically compensated for, they're the same mask as you'd use with contact. They're electrically perfect masks in that they're made with redundancy. Instead of a single layer of chrome, they have two layers of chrome with a silicon monoxide in between, so that if there's a pinhole in the first layer of chrome, the probability of a pinhole aligning in the second layer is practically negligible. They're perfect masks, and we try to keep them that way in use.
You functionally test them. If you've got a structure that isn't iterative, like a shift register, what sort of algorithms do you use to go about formulating a test sequence that would pick up any possible defects?
Basically, we use what has been reported on as a single fault or single failure node analysis. And what we do is, at final test, we assume that the cells that we have interconnected are good as a result of our probe test. And all we're checking on is the validity of the interconnections. Well, the input patterns applied at the input will have to step it through enough patterns so that we can, with a level of confidence, as a result of the outputs, know that the complete sequence is valid. No, it's not a guessing game. It's a game where we assume each node could be stuck at 1 or stuck at 0. And we apply enough test patterns to the input so that at the output, we have a level of confidence that if there is a node that is not operating properly, we can isolate it to which node it is. As a result of the logic function we're trying to implement. We don't need to know the functional requirements of that logic function. All we need to know is which gates and flip-flops are interconnected. Because remember, we're only checking the interconnection pattern, not the gates themselves.
A question on this last subject. Since we have, let's assume we have LSI. Now, the next thing is, how do we manufacture and how do we test them? Like on this new computer that TI has, did you go about how many LSI chips you put on a board? Like the more you put on a board, and at the assembly level, let's say we have to test them for solder joints and anything else we might bring to pack, is there some optimum amount of packs that we can put on a board where it's going to, if we put, let's say, 10 chips on a board, we're going to have just a huge amount of functions that we're going to have to check for. Also, comments on the panel on if they have thought of the number of chips on a board, and how do they do assembly testing?
You're saying, well, I could easily say one, the problem of putting many wafers on a board is the equipment user's problem, but we're faced with that too, obviously. We need to certify to the equipment user in some way or other that wafer that he's receiving is good. And this is the reason for the extreme amount of testing that we do on the device before we ship it. As to the number of wafers or packages you can put on one board, it would be very much dependent on the function you're trying to implement. Obviously, a shift register, you could put use your test probe and find out whether the signal's coming out of one wafer after the other, sort of thing. On random logic, you'd have to develop and utilize test programs very analogous to that used on the wafer itself, treating each wafer as a cell or a module, and play the game at that point. It's not simple. And I don't know that there is any optimum solution to it. It can be a very expensive solution.
Well, Bill, in terms of the complexity levels that you're talking about, you're not really truly testing every gate and every mode on that wafer, are you? You're testing
not
to see if that wafer will perform a particular function within limits.
That's right. Not an exhaustive truth table type of testing.
This would be inconceivable within your lifetime or mine.
It's an economic trade-off. We work with the customers in establishing these test routines.
They, of course, must have a level of confidence in the test routines that we're performing. We'll perform the test routines the customer gives us if he wants to, if he chooses to. We've played games on using this technology of a 200 to 250 gate complexity, where we have seen a customer with an 11-layer PC board containing 250 flat packs. And we have shown that we've been able to take that logic and reduce it to 4 LSI arrays, and the ability to interconnect 4 of these arrays with just a 2-sided PC board. So there's a tremendous reduction. In other words, how do you test a 250 flat pack PC board of 11 layers? This is the equipment manufacturer's problem that he's got now. We're getting involved with that, obviously.
Since I come from an equipment manufacturer, I think I'd like to respond to that question also.
Very good.
You got a dual role.
Yeah, dual role, right. As far as array testing is concerned, we found it perfectly feasible to make sure that every single logic device on the array and the interconnections to those devices is correct. And we test, in fact, before we plot these artworks and go very far through the design of the array, we make sure that the logic is such that every single device can be tested for opens and shorts, and that's what our test procedures really constitute. And we can, with our tester, have a test sequence of up to 258 bits, and we do ensure that each and every device is exercised at least once to detect open and shorted conditions. And we don't let that array go through the design cycle until that logician or designer, as the case may be, has fulfilled that requirement. And every day he'll get a printout, number of devices not tested, 25, and the next day he'll get a printout, number of devices not tested, 5, and the day that thing says number of devices not tested, 0, he shouts Eureka, and we're ready to plot the artwork. Now when we come to the problem of board testing, I don't want to pretend that we've solved this problem, but we do feel that it's amenable to solution because we do plan on performing a 100% inspection of the arrays. So we'll know that the arrays are good. All of the internal devices and external will be good. Now, we know that MOS in particular is somewhat susceptible to electrostatic charge damage. There's no reason to suspect, however, that the internal nodes will be susceptible to damage in any way once they've been verified to be good. So what we intend to do, basically, is to test the board to make sure that the interconnections between the arrays and the input or output devices associated with that array are all good.
I think what you're saying is that you don't design an array and then sit down and figure out how to test it.
No, sir.
You face up to the test problem right at the point when you start designing
the array. We don't plot that artwork until we've got a good test procedure.
Otherwise, you'll never make it.
Never make it.
Way in the back.
They're generated on computer. I beg your pardon, I'm answering. Is this correct?
Yeah, I'd really like to hear different opinions, if there's a difference on how it's done. With a sequential circuit, what sort of criterion is used to make sure that a fault at an internal node will propagate to an output?
It's treated like it can be treated somewhat as a combinational circuit. The clock foot serves as a logic signal input. You step it through. Now you.
Circuits now.
Beg pardon?
Is this only for a synchronous circuit? What about an asynchronous circuit?
Well, certainly the test generation is more complex, and I don't want to lead you to believe that we have computer algorithms that will give us test programs for any and all logic types. Quite a bit of the effort involved, and probably one of the largest facets in our initial costing of a complexity array of this type, is the generation of these test routines. And some of it, while it's not 100% completed by our computer programming, comes pretty close, but we must do some hand completion work. We don't, as Jack does, we don't stop with the array until we have sufficient input test routines and outputs so that we can verify the complete validity of the interconnections.
Could you give me some
discretionary wired wafer would be for a sequential circuit? How many, in other words, how many input sequences?
Oh, you might need several thousand.
Thank
you. Balcony.
We seem to be concerned with the fact that it may be some while before LSI becomes a reality economically. I'm wondering if any of the speakers can see any application or any advantages in LSI from a performance standpoint, even though it may cost a little more in the early part of the game. All of you seem to indicate that you first chose to build a hardware simulator. You chose to build or design a machine out of discrete components and then try and translate that into LSI. That would, to me, indicate that you're not trying to do something with LSI that you couldn't do otherwise. Do you see any applications that might lead us down a different performance path?
Well, I'll answer that by saying that our demonstration vehicle was not a copy of an existing computer, but was a machine designed from scratch to examine the trade-off of adding additional gates to reduce the number of connections to a partitioned area. And certainly there is a functional advantage in using the LSI arrays. I indicated that the power dissipation for an ECL gate of 4 to 5 nanoseconds propagation time goes down from 120 milliwatts to 10 milliwatts. Furthermore, the space saving and having it in an array form rather than spread out in dual inline packages is very appreciable and is a necessity for the next generation of computers where the sheer physical size of the machine is very important. We are, in fact, being limited by the speed of light and transmission throughout the central processor. So there is a functional advantage, and we will be forced to go to some form of LSI, not necessarily the 200-gate level, but perhaps in the 40 to 100-gate level.
In the commercial area, of course, we are extremely cost-conscious. And even if LSI didn't offer anything else but cost, which we feel it does, in MOS at least, we would go that way. However, size, of course, in some of these smaller units I was talking about is extremely important. If you don't want to have a desktop calculator, that's the size of a desk, for example, or a remote terminal where you have to put the electronic unit in a huge closet a few feet away. You'd like to put it all right here on the top of the desk. So we see both advantages.
Well, I'd like to talk about cost and applications. The contract we've had with the avionics lab of the U.S. Air Force for the last two-year period, the name of the contract was Low-Cost Application Flexible Computer. And this was a dual award. The other one was awarded to Bunker Ramo. And we obtained our award because of the indicated low cost of the approach that we took. That resulted from the small number of parts that our approach seemed to indicate. The computer, we have studied it in terms of the application of the guidance of a missile. We've also programmed it on some bombing problems. I was engaged in the 7 or 8 years ago with the Lytton Monroe Division developing an electronic desk calculator. At that time, of course, transistors were expensive, and we'd use logical microprogramming to build a one flip-flop machine. I can see now where this one of these wafers that we're developing could very well be the heart of an electronic desk calculator with advanced computing capabilities. So I definitely see a cost. And in terms of volume, the present packaging technique that we're using, which is a low-cost packaging technique, gives us a volume density of about 1 cubic inch per wafer. And the power requirements are approximately about 1 watt per wafer. These power levels may seem very low when you realize the number of transistors that are on the wafer. It comes about because of short leads, microscopic distances of signal travel, and so forth.
Senator Balcony.
Question whether exhaustive or something less than exhaustive functional testing. In terms of other types, of testing operations, DC parametric testing, and my particular interest, I'm really addressing this question to the whole panel, switching time or dynamic testing or measurements. Do you see an increase or a decrease or about the same level of necessity for this type of testing in LSI terms?
You're referring to the cell itself. Since we do DC probe tests on the cell while it's still in the array form.
Do you see this as dynamic on the cell, functional only on the
At probe, what we call probe test, where we put all the little probe pins down on the pads in the cell, we are doing AC or dynamic testing there. We do parametric in the form of level test. We try to define enough tests of this type to certify to the validity that that cell will operate at the frequencies and the environment that we want it to at final test. After our discretionary array is interconnected, we do complete testing then as a packaged device. I'm sure this is what Jerry does with his ECL stop.
Yes, I think it's been our experience, and I believe it's the industry experience, at least in non-saturating type gates at least, that there's a very good correlation between the DC parameter testing and the AC performance once it's packaged.
In our case, of course, we use dynamic logic, four-phase dynamic logic. So, you know, really static tests have no meaning. We would typically, for example, probe testing would be done at 50 kilohertz. And, of course, here this is an abnormal condition because the prober itself puts more capacitance on the unit than it would ever see. But at that level, we are testing the function only. Then in the finished package test, and particularly at our plant after the supplier has sent us the finished arrays, we would perform, first of all, frequency margining tests. In other words, the worst possible thing I can visualize is to have arrays in the field and equipment that work most of the time. That if you got a temperature change of 20 degrees outside, that you got what more leakage or the propagation delays got too long or what have you. So we want to be sure that we have adequate voltage and frequency margins. So we will do several kinds of plots. For example, we'll change our frequencies and examine the points at which the output comparators will detect a 0 or a 1 and plot this as a function of frequency. And again, while varying frequency, we would see what input level is required to make those arrays function. And we have a great deal more work to do in this area. On the next dozen or two dozen or maybe the next 100 array types to make sure we have enough data to indicate that our designs are not marginal, that they will hold up in the field.
I'd like to make a comment about the testing. Of course, you have to break it into two parts. The first part is the checkout of the logical design. The second part is once you've got the logical design checked out, you're going to want to do the kind of testing that detects flaws in terms of the manufacturing process. As far as a logical design checkout is concerned, we've taken the approach of basically designing the arithmetic cell to the point where we can see that it's, you know, everything we want to do is there and it's in the right size and so forth, and we've checked it as well as we can. But then we break it up again and take, for instance, the accumulator, the adder, the function control, and so forth, and expand them out in terms of putting a lot of test points on and drivers so that we can check them out individually. And these subsections of the arithmetic cell will be fabricated on wafers and checked out individually by probing. We do have a medium-sized general-purpose digital computer that's just come in that's going to be used to generate the signal patterns to test out these parts of the machine. And we have generated the logical sequences that would check them out. Now, in the second stage of the thing, at least for the particular computer that we're doing at Litton, the thing that we'd be testing would be completely checked out arithmetic units. And checking out a complete arithmetic unit is easier than checking out subsections, oddly enough. Because a complete arithmetic unit, you've got a small number of input buses. You can send in numbers into it. You can make it do the arithmetic functions you want to do, and you can test the answers that you get back again. So you can exercise it in the basic operations. But it's a different ballgame with the type of computer we're building than the other type of computers.
With regard to the present state of the art, if you were designing your arithmetic units right now, approximately how many active devices would you have per unit, and what type of yield would you expect? How many good AUs per chip would you
expect? Let me answer your question by reporting on some results that we've obtained. Of course, that's the question we ask ourselves, and it's a very vital question. We have this yield evaluation wafer, which I've alluded to. In the yield evaluation wafer, we attempted to pack as many transistors as we possibly could within the basic 160 mil area that we're concerned with, because that's the area we're living with, 160 mils. Now, that seems like a large area. It is a large area, although there are, people can make this. The semiconductor manufacturers assure us that they have lens systems now that can handle this. Several associative memories, for example, were announced recently that are roughly in this ballpark. Chips of this size have been made with that large an area. This yield evaluation wafer that we had packed in 160 mil area, because it's just shift registers, something like 6,400 transistors. That's a lot of transistors. That's more transistors than our arithmetic unit will be. The arithmetic unit is 2,700 transistors because you don't have the repetitive pattern of a shift register in your arithmetic unit. Test results are limited because the number of wafers, you're not making 10,000 wafers.